Thank you.
I know. I didn't think of that.
We're going to. You do.
I had sense to get this camp so everyone had like a radio voice. He said he was actually trying to get on the radio.
I blew my opportunity, I guess.
And then, so I'm going to do the welcome and introduce the
Don is
fire.
No, thank you.
You guys are going to talk about personal stories of time in terms of the entrepreneurial
She reports Don is on his way. He's using the restroom.
And then we're going to have
Don's ready.
Questions.
just outside.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. So we're going to have questions. Very cheap. Right.
Sounds good.
All right.
Those are the questions I had. I said to somebody the other day, the good news is the process takes so long, but by the time it's over, you no longer have imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely, because I'm just handing my papers for the first time.
You probably don't have imposter syndrome anyway, but...
Well, nobody's exempt, alas.
Yeah, it's true.
Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome. Can everybody hear me okay? All right. You are in session number 438, The Many Faces of Community Ministry. My name is Michelle Walsh, Reverend Michelle Walsh, and I am the membership director and president-elect for the UU Society for Community Ministries. I'm very excited to have our three presenters today talking about entrepreneurial community ministry in its many forms. So the format that we're going to follow is that I'm going to read the bio for each of the folks here and have them each talk for a few minutes and share some personal stories about their paths. And then I'll have some questions for the three of them to discuss together. And then we're going to open it up to everybody. Sound good? Okay. And everybody can hear me okay? Just thumbs up? Okay, good. All right. Reverend Don Southworth is the founding executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, where he has served for 6 years. He has served congregations in San Francisco, Atlanta, and Durham, North Carolina, since his graduation from the Starr King School for the Ministry in 2000. He has led workshops on stewardship and growth in the United States and England, and is the co-designer of the Beyond the Call Entrepreneurial Ministry Program. Before he entered the ministry, he worked in sales, marketing, training, and various management positions in the corporate world. And seated next to him is Brock Leach. Reverend Brock Leach is Vice President for Mission, Strategy, and Innovation at the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, the denomination's International Human Rights and Crisis Response Agency. Brock's primary responsibilities are to strengthen the agency's impact and nurture innovation. He helped create and launch the UU College of Social Justice, yay, and the Commit to Respond Climate Justice Campaign, double yay, and UUSC Justice Building, a program to support congregations and members in leading more effective and sustained justice work. He is also a member of the planning team for the Beyond the Call Entrepreneurial Ministry Program. And last, but certainly not least, is Reverend Tandy Rogers. Reverend Tandy Rogers. She's served the UUA since 2002 and is currently the Innovation and Network Specialist, and she'll probably let us know what that means exactly. She's also served as the UUA Growth Strategist, Interim Director of Youth and Young Adult Ministries, and the Program Specialist in the Pacific Northwest. Prior to UU Ministry, Tandy was the development officer for her local ecumenical agency and a teacher on the Muckleshoot Reservation. While she calls herself an quote-unquote institutional minister, her core identity remains religious educator, and she is a proud credentialed religious educator at the master's level. Woo! Okay. So I will invite Don to start us off, followed by Brock and Tandy.
You're sitting or standing?
Of course.
It's up to you.
Stand?
I'll go preach.
Okay, go preach.
I can't believe I told Don Sopper what to do.
Thank you, Michelle. So I learned a lesson this year. I'm a slow learner. But when you have a title or a theme for GA called Building a New Way, and you have a reputation of being the entrepreneurial, innovative guy, and they have you go to workshop after workshop and talk to the delegates and everything, I'm looking forward to it. I don't know what next year's theme is yet, but I'm hoping it's something like the deep theological roots of 19th century humanism or something. So I can just maybe sleep a little bit during GA too. So thanks for coming. I want to appreciate and thank Michelle for helping to both introduce and kick this off, but also she was a partner in creating this as well with us. So I want to thank Michelle. And if you don't know Brock and Tandy, they're two of the brightest minds in our movement. And I'm really lucky that I get to work with them once in a while. So we sometimes have these disagreements about who has the best job in the world. And we haven't arm wrestled yet, but maybe we will one day. So it's good to share a panel with you. That would probably be true. So we're just going to, now, do we do a time on this? I don't want to over-preach.
Do you do a timer?
3 minutes?
You
five
should
minutes,
time
minutes?
It.
Five?
Put me on the timer, because you know
five
me, I'll get going.
Least, yeah.
So we're just going to share a little bit about our own kind of background, a little bit personal, but also the roles we have and why these are important for building a new way. So as Michelle told you, my background's a bit diverse, especially I came out of the corporate world, but I came out of a corporate world where businesses can have heart. And I went to seminary, and I always like to tell a story that when I went to seminary in Berkeley at Starr King, I went to my interview in a three-piece suit. And even though this is the 90s when still people wore suits, I didn't really fit in. And my first sermon that I gave at Starr King was with a colleague of mine who came from social work. And so the sermon was titled, The Antichrist Meets Goody Two-Shoes. And I was always hurt that nobody wondered who was who, you know. So when I got into parish ministry, when I entered seminary, I wasn't sure if I was going which direction my ministry would take. I thought I might go back to the business world and bring ethics and values, which the business world needs more of. Or I thought I might go to the religious world and bring more business-related thinking, which the religious world needed. I fell in love with parish ministry and spent about 10 years in parish ministry and served on the executive committee of the UUMA, the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association. And we were a volunteer-driven organization, and our ministers paid about $200 a year, and we did an occasional program at GA or at ministry days, but there wasn't a lot of juice there. And I was on the board and said, let's see what we can do. And we asked our members if they wanted to increase their dues by 300 or 400%. And this was 2009 when we asked them this, right after the biggest, you know, downturn in our generation economic-wise. And there was a lot of discussion and some disagreement. But the membership decided to do that, and I was hired as the acting executive director a few months later, partly because I missed entrepreneurial work. And I figured, okay, go jump into an acting executive director job after having kind of, I thought, the nirvana of UU-ism. I was the senior minister of a large congregation, you know, and that was supposed to be my end-all, but it turns out that there was more to do. My ministry took a different turn. And in the last 6 years, we've done amazing things that blow all of us away. 6 years ago today, we had one person on the staff of the UUMA. Now we have six. Our budget's tripled over the last 6 years. I'm in very rarefied company as a nonprofit executive director who can speak about this type of growth and transformation in the last 6 years. And it's because of a lot of reasons, mostly because members who wanted to make a different type of commitment and lead in different ways. Our mission is to nurture excellence in ministry through continuing education, collaboration, and collegiality. And as we often say, it's not nurture excellent ministers. It's very intentional about nurturing excellent ministry. So we do a lot of partnership all over the place. What I've learned is that I've been doing entrepreneurial ministry. You might call it intrapreneurial. We use the distinction sometimes entrepreneurial and intrapreneurial. Entrepreneurial is starting brand new from scratch, and I didn't do that. entrepreneurials you take can exist, do new initiatives in the context of an existing organization. So that's kind of what I did. But what the timing was perfect because I got into this role and all this stuff started to happen all over the place about Congregations Beyond Walls and the nuns are taking over the religious world, which means we're all going to be out of jobs, whether they're volunteer or paid, you know, within a decade or two. And so all this stuff's going on, and I get to be somebody, the only person really in the whole world whose job is to support and nurture and develop Unitarian Universalist ministers exclusively. So I kind of have the only job in the world like that. We have people on our UUA staff who are dedicated to ministry, but it's in a different context. So what we've been playing with the last 6 years is a lot of experimentation. We've done a lot of new things, and we try very hard to make them kind of in the spirit of experimentation. And what that's led us to, among other things, is a new program that Brock and I are helping to create called Beyond the Call Entrepreneurial Ministry, which is a 2-year program where we've got not only UU ministers, but rabbis, UCC ministers, and religious professionals of non-ministerial stripes studying with business schools around the country on how to lead and develop innovation. One of the things that, and I'll end this, is because it's always like, wow, this guy's a little crazier than I even thought, was about 3-4 years ago, I started looking at all the way the world was changing and read Steve Jobs' biography that came out. And I've always been a St. Francis guy. So I went to my spiritual director after visiting Apple Computers in Silicon Valley. I said, I've got it. What I want to create is what I've made up the word now, called entrepreneurship. I want to mash up Steve Jobs, who's done innovation and technology, with St. Francis. So what I did is I went and took a month off and went to Assisi for 2 weeks and then to Silicon Valley for 3 weeks and started interviewing people who are doing this blending of innovation, religion, social entrepreneurship. And what we discovered was some of the leading edge thinking isn't in religious circles, it's in business schools. So that's why we've created this program. And what we're trying to do is keep pushing new ways of looking at the world, which we think is critical to the success of the future. So that's a little bit about me. Who's next?
Brock.
I'm just curious, how many folks here are either ministers or thinking maybe about ministry?
Oh,
perfect. You can't tell from up here. You know,
well, the halo's for everybody. We see everybody's halo.
Yeah. So let me just, my journey is somewhat similar to Don's, but I'm going to take you all the way back to my childhood.
Wow.
No, I'm not. It's
really. A long way.
it is a long way. So I will take you partway back. Like many of you, I had an experience as a teenager where I was mentored by, it happened to be a UCC minister, who believed that the work of the church happened outside the walls of the church, and the church was a place of nurture for that work. And so he took a bunch of us who were teenagers on what he called outreach trips. We would call them social justice trips. But at any rate, he called them outreach, and we went, this was rural Colorado. And we went and worked with migrant farm workers gleaning vegetables, and we worked at alcohol rehabilitation centers, and we built a Head Start center in Canales County, Colorado, where it was minus 27 degrees in January, and we slept in the trailers of migrant farm workers and had the most wonderful food and the most warm welcome, and it changed my life. That, you know, I was a shy kid who felt like, you know, I don't know what my impact on the world could be. But being one-on-one with people who had a completely different experience of the world than I had, and knowing that we could help each other, was hugely empowering. And so we did all these different things. And some of them you wouldn't do today because they'd be too dangerous. But at any rate, we did them. And I came through at like age 17, and I said to him, hey, I want to do what you're doing. I want to be a minister. And he said, well, you know, the work of ministry takes many different forms. He said, you know, and you have some leadership skills, and maybe, you know, you should just try different things before you decide you really want to do that. I was hurt by that. You know, come on. It wasn't the vote of confidence that I was hoping for. Anyway, but I did take his advice. So I went to college, and I did lots of different things. I discovered I kind of liked management and organizations, and I went to business school. And then I thought, well, I really want to get an experience of leading broadly,
so that I can be a nonprofit social justice kind of leader. And so I started in consumer products, of all things, selling snack food at Frito-Lay, because I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to learn a lot about how businesses operate. And then 24 years went by. And several people asked me, they want me to explain this transition into ministry from there, and they want me to tell a story of despairing, and I can't, because I had a great career. I was just really lucky. And what was great about it was that the things I loved to do were innovation related. Like Don, I had a lot of experience with entrepreneurship. And it was a kind of company that would say, fine, you want to do that? Go. You know, have at it. Good luck. And so I was able to do that all lots of different ways and learn a lot. And I ended up running Frito-Lay North America and then Tropicana Products. And then I was chief innovation officer for the company, for PepsiCo. And then the whole time I'm thinking, well, when I get fired, I'm going to go to seminary. Because, you know, it was likely that I would. I was doing this stuff that really was outside the dots a little bit. And I never really got fired. I got fired for a day, but that's a longer story. But I got to the point where I really felt like I'd done what I wanted. And I quit to go to seminary in 2006. And almost everybody I ran into, even though I'd never said anything about that to my corporate colleagues, almost all of them said, well, of course. You know, which is living proof that, you know, you do ministries in lots of different ways, whether you're called a minister or not. So anyway, I was really privileged to go to Mutual Lombard, and it happened that along that way I ran into Bill Schultz, and I ended up doing the work that I'd done corporately for UUSC. And so College of Social Justice was kind of an idea that was in a strategic plan, but it had never been described what it was, so helping that get going. And most of what I've been doing is helping build collaborations across the Unitarian Universalist world, because I discovered in my business life that the best ideas never, ever have single owners. You know, they always start with a spark and people have common objectives, and something great emerges, which is that sense of that which is larger than ourselves for me, that you could not have conceived of ahead of time or individually. So anyway, that's the work that I've been really honored and privileged to be able to do at UUSC. And so then Don, like, I don't know, a year and a half ago, wrote me into this idea of what if we helped ministers who are doing real entrepreneurship work, what if we helped them build a startup community where they could learn from experts and like have an executive learning program, expert business school teachers, and religious innovators, people who are actually succeeding with doing this kind of work, and they could be a community for each other, and they could share learning, and we could improve our success rate, you know, with some of these ideas. And that's just great. You know, there's 26 people that have these ideas that are all over the map, and not all of them are going to work. In fact, you know, the reality of the world is a minority of them are really going to work, but we're going to learn a lot. And they're going to learn a lot together, and they're going to be a community for each other. So I wouldn't have said this a year and a half ago, but I would now say my ministry is a entrepreneurial social justice ministry. And I'm not sure where it's going to lead, but that'll be the theme going forward.
I am going to go back to my childhood, but I'm not going to stay there for very long. Only because I imagine that a lot of you are sitting there wondering how your story leads to an entrepreneurial ministry, whether it's a lowercase m or a capital M. It's helpful to know, it's like, okay, so I've got a playful energy about me and a presence that people, you know, recognize. And I think it helps to know that I come from a farming family in Ohio, generations of farmers on my mom's side. I didn't know that we were poor till I went to college, and I was the first in my family to go to college. And so my grandpa would, like when the refrigerator door broke and wouldn't close, we didn't get a new refrigerator because that was a big deal. He would make some sort of contraption that you pulled a lever, closed it, and you know there was a special latch. And, you know, that game Mousetrap, we would, oh my gosh, my grandpa and I would, and my cousins, we would make all sorts of little okay, end of the day, I'm losing words, is the thing you make that does, inventions. We would make all these little inventions. Thank you for playing my game. Words are not my first language. We would make all these little inventions that would address some sort of challenge in our midst. And it also helps to know that my daddy was a failed salesman until the last couple years of his life. He was an entrepreneur and also a very poor side of the family. He didn't graduate from high school. But he would see magic all around him, and he would see need all around him and would find ways to do things that we just never thought were possible. So this is what I grew up in, you know? And he was, he died a very successful man, because in the last 4 years of his salesmanship, he finally found the thing that he loved to sell. And that's what I learned all my life also, is find the thing that turns you on, that is your joy, that gets you up in the morning, and go there. Be your authentic self and go there. So at age 7 is when I was called to be a minister. And in my family, there's 3 honorable professions that you can have: a farmer, a minister, or a teacher. Now, in Northern Ohio, at that time, the only ministers I knew were either Protestant or Catholic, and I didn't know what the Catholic ministers looked like, the priests, because we didn't mix. And I'm serious. Oh, my Lord. I dated a Catholic, and you would have thought all hell was breaking loose. And the ministers that I knew were white males, and we were a tiny throwaway town, so they weren't always fully sane. And and you know, so I didn't see myself in the pulpit. And my grandma, one time, I go to my grandma, and I'm like, oh my God, my heart is about to burst. Can a heart really burst? I was worried about it. And as my wise grandma would say, what are you going to do with that? And my answer was, I think I'm going to be a minister, which was ridiculous, because I don't know where I got that idea. And her response was, what makes you think you aren't already a minister? And so I felt commissioned by my grandma to be the lowercase m. And, you know, in my high school, it said, you know, those little surveys, if you go in the yearbook, I'm most likely to become a minister. And I was like that person. Okay, so we didn't have OWL back then, but if we did, you would have recognized me as an OWL facilitator in the high school. I was a little Miss Safety Pants. And I mean, because we wanted to get out of that small town, and the only way to do that was to get out to college or wherever you needed to go, you know? And so it was a big deal. In college, a professor put, we were trying to invent a religion that would save the world, and we would meet around in a circle and light it candle and check in and have a reflection, and we were talking about how we were going to behave together to create our larger, and anyway, a professor got word of it, put her arm around me and said, I'm taking you to church, and we all went and were stunned that it had already been invented. They were an emerging congregation, and this is, you know, I find it fascinating that I now help shepherd emerging congregations and ministries. They sat in horrible chairs, awful acoustics, all gray-haired, had no idea what to do with us. I was already raising money for our college's endowment, and I was so happy to raise money, they had no idea to even ask me that. Of that cohort, one went on to be the vice president of United Way and is still a Unitarian Universalist. Actually, we all are in different ways. And so I went off, and I became a teacher because that was the honorable thing, and that actually has always been my first call. And even what I'm doing now, I see as teaching, because I create cultures of learning, and that's what we need in the 21st century, less learned and more learning. And so when I create, you know, those teams and those networks, it's always, and some of you know because you've been in one of my innovative learning circles or something, or gold mine, and, you know, so we create these big learning communities that can go out and then, you know, unleash our joy and goodness and big love on the world. The district called me up specifically because there was a change agent kind of job, and I already was on, I think, every committee in the district when we had committees, and they're like, you know what you're doing, come in and do it. Oh, you need to know, prior to that, when I was a teacher on the Muckleshoot Reservation, every year we would add a grade. When I went there, we were in fourth grade, we'd add a grade every year, and we would be given a classroom with nothing in it. And so that trained me to ask people for help. I'm the one that opened up the high school with no budget.
And so again, trained, my training with my, I just felt that my ancestor, my grandpa with me through all that. And I think that speaks to entrepreneurialism is what's the need, and then you find a way. Resources, money follows mission. I really believe that. And if money and resources aren't following, either the mission isn't ready yet, or the people aren't ready yet, or the mission needs to be tweaked, or it's somebody else's to do. I've had a lot of stuff. I'm like, I want to do it. No, it's somebody else's to do. And then it's this beautiful thing to watch an idea that has my fingerprints on it live large and somebody else take it in a way that I could never have done myself. So I think an entrepreneurial also kind of has that kind of feeling. Now, here's the thing with our tradition. I know a lot of ministers, I'll hear from folks in the pathway to ministry, God called me. And I get that, because my seven-year-old self, I get that. I didn't go into ministry until my community called me. And I always ask that when somebody says they want to go into ministry, particularly community ministry, who's calling you? It was the ministers in my district that called me into ministry, and by that call, I'm an institutional minister. Someday I want to go back to my community, my Muckleshoot community, and go back to community ministry. Right now, I'm being called by you to be an institutional minister. Can you hand me that T-shirt? So I get all the time people going, oh my God, I want your job. And I ask, wow, what do you think my job is? Because it's a really sparkly title, right? Innovation and Network Specialist. Holy crap, who gets to do that? So I actually had to make a T-shirt that said what I do because my own staff team still didn't know what I did. And I got this to remind my boss of what I do.
And so when I know what you do.
Yeah. And it says on the bottom, other sparkly things as assigned. So how did I get the job? By doing, showing that I'm actually doing something. And it wasn't to get the job. It was because there was something that needed to happen. Connecting, creating impact, proven impact, building capacity. So it's an awful lot of stuff I've done that nobody will ever know it was me. It's empowering other people to be their best. Experimenting, failing miserably most of the time, but the times I get it right, there we go. And creating a culture of learning.
Tandy, can I have that T-shirt back for a second? So I'm sure most of you in the back could not see what it says. It says, so Innovation and Network Specialist. These are the things she does. It's amazing. Breakthrough Congregations, Emerging Ministries Co-Coordinator, Growing Unitarian Universalism Blog and Facebook, Innovative Learning Circles, Middle Integration Support, Multi-Site Ministries Coordinator, UUA Research and Assessment, Other Sparkly Things as Assigned. We had some questions that you guys wanted to discuss. And I actually want to start with a different one first, which is what are your respective definitions of entrepreneurial ministry? You each of them touched on it in more or less depth, but if you could just clarify, what do you mean when you say entrepreneurial ministry, particularly community ministry?
Do you want us to go in order again?
I think we should go reverse order this
time. Okay.
We can use the
Okay. Okay, so I've been thinking about this. Okay, so I think that entrepreneurial ministry is that that response to a change and a challenge in your community. And we all are so busy. You know, you go, and there's this overstimulation and overinformation. And I think it requires actually a lot of stillness so that you can listen and really watch what's going on, not what's being fed to you through media or your shoulds or your ego or any of that. But what's really going on in the community that is yours to address? It takes somebody who gets excited when things go wrong because you're about to learn something. I love that. It drives my partner nuts, who really likes things to go a certain way. But for me, it's like practicing strategy. So there's that. Like, I love getting lost somewhere. It's like being misplaced. It's like, oh, we're about to learn something. And also knowing that you can't do it alone is so incredibly important.
So here's the piece of knowing what your strengths are, what your charism is in service to the whole, so that you can come with yourself without apology and find the partners that can complement that. So like in emerging ministries, you saw the list. I can't go really deep without good partners. So in Emerging Ministries Highway, we actually have the team has like subtitles that we use among ourselves. I'm the vision keeper, and Annie Gonzalez Milliken is my scrum lord. We use scrum as a kind of organizing. So she's like the keeper of all details. There is no way. And she's like learning. She's like, wow, I didn't even think that we could go that way. And then together we figure out a way. So there's that partnership. And a good entrepreneurial knows that they can't do it alone and how to work together. No public whining. I get a lot of people who have really great ideas and then sometimes come to the UUA mad that we won't give them money. And they call themselves an entrepreneur. And I want to say, no. I don't even think many entrepreneurs that I know call themselves entrepreneurs because they're so busy. They're too busy doing the stuff.
Right.
So, and that, I said earlier, acknowledging that sometimes the timing could be off or it's not yours to do. So there's kind of that openness of allegiance to the larger.
We just want to go in order. What I was going to say is very similar to what Tandy said. I think all ministry is, to one degree or another, entrepreneurial. I mean, everyone, you're out there constructing a career in a self-guided spiritual way that entrepreneurs follow. They follow a calling. But my way of thinking about entrepreneurialism in ministry is that it's meeting unmet needs. And bringing what we have as people to those needs. So in entrepreneur speak, it would be product market fit.
Yeah.
You know, it would be doing the definition of what are the needs, the spiritual needs, the justice needs, the human wholeness needs of a community. And doing that by observing, you know, what entrepreneurs do isn't so much create an idea and run off and do it. They are very good about figuring out the unmet need that isn't articulated, that they can observe in how people are living their lives. So it's doing that work, which I think, again, all ministers are called to do. Mm-hmm. And then it's figuring out, how do I bring my whole self and the whole selves of others into meeting that need? And that's hard, but that's also true in, you know, the regular entrepreneurial business world of figuring out, you know, it's easy to see the need. It's very hard to see what's the exact combination mm-hmm. Of attributes that's going to meet that need. But I think that's what we do as ministers, and I think that's the heart of entrepreneurial ministry. It's being always vigilant of what's going on in a community that needs to be supported and addressed, and what can we bring to it? Not me alone, what do I have to bring, but what can a group of people bring to it?
So Peter Morales and I started talking about this program on entrepreneurial ministry a few years ago. You know, he was talking about things like Congregations Beyond Walls, and I was running around Italy and Silicon Valley looking for people who are doing different things in the world. And so as we talk, well, what are we going to call this program? And we had lots of conversations. Should we call it innovative ministries? Should we call it emerging ministry? You know, we had all these conversations because we realized whatever word you use is going to trigger a reaction in someone. I don't get too hung up on the definition. I'm pretty simple guy. I look back at what the Latin was. Not that I'm a Latin guy, but I like to say, what's it start of? Ministry comes from, you can call it lots of things, but it basically comes from service. It comes from to serve. That's where ministry comes from. Entrepreneurial comes from creating new. It's basically newness. So when I think of entrepreneurial ministry, I'm thinking about what are new ways to serve the whole, the world, God, call it what you want. Brock may remember the first meeting we had about thinking about this. And when I started on this mashing up Steve Jobs and St. Francis, and believe it or not, they have both have a lot in common. St. Francis was a spiritual entrepreneur long before Steve Jobs was in anybody's eyes. And so I actually said, okay, what am I started a blog in 2012. What am I going to call it? So I'm looking for what's this right word? And so finally I said, there's no word that exists. So I created a new word. And I had done this before in the corporate world, kind of figured out, well, language is just creating, we make all our language up, and it's to coordinate action. So it's like making new words up. Anybody can do it. It's pretty fun. So I actually said, okay, I'm going to make up this new word, cultrepreneurship. And it was kind of cool, so I called my blog Cultrepreneurship, and within a couple weeks, it's in Google. You search cultrepreneurship. There you go. You create a word. And they said, well, we can't call it the Cultrepreneurship Program. But for me, that's what it is. It's about the idea of creating new ways of serving something larger than ourselves. And that's what cultrepreneurship is. And it's, you know, I can say that because I made the word up, see. But they didn't want to use my word. I can understand that. We decided, do we want to use emerging, innovative, and decided entrepreneurial, because it really is kind of the combination. Social entrepreneurship is, I love what's happening in the world around social entrepreneurship. And what they did is they took this entrepreneurship word, which is about new and has this business connotation, and added social. And what business schools and other college programs are starting to teach these social entrepreneurs, because what's happening is millennials are coming in and they're going to perhaps get MBA degrees, but they don't want to go out in the corporate world making millions of bucks for shareholders. They want to use those principles to change the world. So they take this kind of entrepreneurial thinking, and then they go to Africa and figure out how are we going to serve populations that don't have water. And they're doing amazing things, and I want to learn from those, because to be honest, liberal religion in general, usually isn't on the cutting edge of early adopters and creating new innovation for change. So part of what we're about, at least what I'm about, and I think these two are too, how do we bring some of that sense of urgency and new ways of looking to the world to our liberal religious faith?
Great. I like going to the Latin root, or the root meaning of words, something that I do myself. And from that, we know that ministry is what we all do together, because we all serve in one way or another. And Unitarian Universalist Society of Community Ministries supports lay people who are community ministers, as well as clergy. So we specifically use the word clergy to talk about those who are ordained and have special training and are called forth from the laity. What, in your mind, is the special, unique gifts that clergy bring to this work, in contrast? Anybody can go.
Sure. I realized I didn't write down my notes. No, I never really thought about this. I've thought about it throughout my life, because I chose to have my first degree when I was at Muckleshoot. I knew I had a call to ministry. I was really active in my home congregation, and people were kind of hemming and hawing, and I was in the pulpit a lot, and they're like, oh, you should really be a minister. But parish ministry didn't ever speak to me, and I was doing a lot of innovating in my teaching setting, and so I was faced with the decision, do I get an M.Ed., a Master's of Education, or a Master's of Divinity? And I chose the Master's of Education, because I felt at that time I had my congregation Monday through Friday all day, and we could go deep and make a big difference, and I believe that we did make a big difference together, and still do. We're connected in Facebook, praise all things good. And when I finally came to choose the path to ministry, and by the way, I don't have an MDiv, I have an equivalency, so talk to me if that's ever been a challenge for you. I couldn't afford to keep going and just stopped and said, claim me, I'm done, claim me. But I do have the equivalency. What I found in my work is it shifted from being a job into being something so much larger, and that I have a courage, I guess, which certainly makes my family members a little bit nervous at times, because I don't serve the association, I don't serve a job, I serve larger love, and I took vows to do that. So there's a freedom, actually, that comes with that. And what I didn't expect is that freedom actually makes me much better in the job. And I also hold people differently, that it's not so much goal-oriented as it is faith formation, religious identity-oriented.
This is religious work that we do. And so I put people and relationships in our covenant first over goals and product.
I think of ministry as separate from tasks and roles, as a location or an orientation from which to approach the work.
Yep.
So my work is currently organizational work. It's institutional work. And what I do in terms of tasks and roles is, in some cases, pretty similar to what I did in my corporate life. The difference is that I'm approaching it from the point of view of how are we realizing these collective outcomes that we aspire to that might change the world? Mm-hmm. And how do we do so in nurturing our spirits and becoming whole people along the way? And that's a different orientation than you might have found in the corporate world in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a matter more of how you are oriented and approach the work than it is specifically of the work. It happens that when you approach it that way, a lot of things unfold. I end up doing a lot of what I would call pastoral care ministry to people in our institution because I've assumed that role. And that's tricky because you can't do it in any way that there's a reporting relationship involved. But it's really useful. And the only other thing I'd say is that churches in particular, but nonprofit organizations, are some ways much more challenged institutionally to have, they need ministerial leadership more because the outcomes are harder to define and fuzzier for people in a lot of cases. And because in a lot of cases, corporations spend more time developing people and helping people figure out what they're really good at and how to align themselves than do nonprofit institutions or churches, surprisingly. So the idea of being a minister in a nonprofit or organizational setting is really much needed, even if the work that you actually do is there's more technical roles involved.
Yeah, I'd answer that kind of three ways. First is kind of a little bit back to my background. When I was in my 20s, I started to really kind of, one of my first kind of spiritual journeys was into Buddhism. And I read this book and learned about right livelihood. And I like to say it basically screwed up the rest of my life because it talked about integrating whatever you do, whatever that is you do, with service to a larger whole is my definition of it. And so I was blessed when I was in the corporate world to have these people around me who were ministers, literally ministers, in the sense that I had a vice president of a Fortune 50 company. He taught me how to meditate. We spent our lunch hours meditating together. So I kind of, even when I was in the corporate world, I was trying to live in this concept of right livelihood. So then I get ordained as a minister after going through seminary, and as an ordained clergy, I've got kind of I've got vows that I've made to both a community, which is in this case Unitarian Universalism, and to God, define that what you is. So I've now, no matter what I do, I've got reverend in front of my name, and so it's kind of more official or more deeper, or I can't get out of that. You know, when you're ordained as a minister, I can do a lot of things to screw up and be thrown out of Unitarian Universal Fellowship. I can get a divorce. I've been married almost 30 years. But I'm ordained by a community. I've got reverend for life, right or wrong. But then the other thing I would say is it's all about context. And I like to tell this story because I've done some work over in England. And if you know anything about England, I recommend everybody go spend, if you want to both be sobered and inspired, go spend some time with our England Unitarian brothers and sisters, people who are serving congregations. I think the largest congregation in England is about 25 or 30 people who actually show up. There's bigger ones, maybe I think there's up to 100, but it's not very many. So I spent some time over there. I've loved the folks over there. I've done some workshops with them. I went to preach at one of the London congregations. It's actually a thriving, growing congregation led by one of our colleagues that's gone from like 10 to about 70, you know, and have got much more of a community set up. So I preached, and you know, it was okay to say my name for that, but then I also led a meditation workshop in the afternoon. And I said, I'm just curious, Andy is the minister over there. I said, no big deal to me, but why isn't Reverend up there on your wayside pulpit about who I was? You know, usually you go to a congregation, they have a wayside pulpit. So he says, well, because we wanted people to come, Don. And in England, Reverend is not seen as anybody consistent or relevant you want to hang around with. So in my current setting, as the executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Ministerial Association, I think a non-ordained person now might be able to do it. But as I came in, I would say there's no way somebody from outside ordained clergy could have come in as the executive director of the UUMA and done the things that I've done. I mean, people think I'm a little nuts anyway, colleagues, like, what is this guy? But at least they know that I'm covenanted in community with them. And so I think some of this is context, that yeah, you perhaps, you don't have to be a minister to do certain things, and there's times when you, being a minister really helps. I mean, literally saying I am a reverend. And there's sometimes where that's not the most important thing, but I walk in the world as a minister. So no matter what I do, I'm always going to be bringing that, whether it's serving as executive director. I could go back in the corporate world, you know, and I would still bring that persona. I would be doing ministry. They may not put reverend on my business card.
Yep. Thank you, Don. That was very helpful and kind of where I wanted to see the question go. What difference does it make to be ordained? Okay, there's a fundamental identity change in that process. We still prefer to use the language of clergy, that we're becoming clergy, because ministry is all that we do, and we want to recognize that. What have you learned about this larger landscape of this changing religious landscape that's happening in terms of Unitarian Universalism, what's happening in the country and the world and the changing demographics? I mean, there's so much going on right now. What have you learned in terms of the importance and significance of entrepreneurial community ministry and how this is helpful for this period of time?
It's helpful because entrepreneurs are innovators who dream big dreams. Now, a lot of them never make those dreams come true because of finance or everything else. But they look at the world in a different way. I joke with Peter, and it's true, I say, if liberal religion was a stock, and not that I have a good track record of picking stocks, but if liberal religion was a stock, I wouldn't buy it. Because when you buy a stock, you look at past performance, right? And when I look at liberal religion as institutions, liberal religion does not have a good history of seeing a changing world and changing internally to address that changing world in ways to meet the needs of the changing world. To be honest, our fundamentalist brothers and sisters are much quicker to do that, have been historically. But I do have a great belief in the power of people. And so the world's changing so fast. I mean, I'm in a lot of meetings where we put up these, you know, the easel pages with the trends of the future 25 years. And most people start, the more we put up, the frowns go deeper and the shoulders sag more. And the truth is, most entrepreneurs have a spirit and a mood of possibility. So when we put all that stuff on the easel, we make it true or not. I mean, anybody who argues that more people in millennial are going to be more likely to walk in organized religion, if you want to make that argument, you can. I'd probably say, have you got medication? So that's probably going to change, right? That doesn't mean Unitarian Universalism is dead. What it means is, okay, we can either react to that and say, we're dead. And I've got ministers, you know, my job's ministers. And, you know, they think they're not going to have jobs, right? This is serious. You can see that, and that could be your reaction. Your reaction could say, cool, okay. So we're going to have to find new ways to bring our faith to these people, right? And it's probably not going to look like a Sunday morning. They're never going to step in on a Sunday morning. So are we just going to say, oh, well, we'll just write that 60% off? Are we going to create new ways? I mean, I love that, you know, some of you may not like Apple stuff, and I'm not like a Jobs junkie. I mean, I came to Apple late in life. but what I love is what they did is they created created new markets, right? Who would have ever dreamed that this thing would exist even 15 years ago? Like, you're going to carry around, you've read some of these things, to carry around 1,000 songs in your pocket. First of all, why would you want to do that, right? innovation and people who look at the world in different ways respond to the world in different ways. Our first retreat for the entrepreneurial program was on design thinking, which I hadn't learned a lot about until I hung out in Silicon Valley and Stanford a little bit. And design thinking is, you can look up what it is, but the reason we wanted that to be the first skill set for our class was because they need lots of things. They need fundraising, they need planning, they need all that stuff. But design thinking basically is a way to look at the world differently. And it's about thinking in new ways. And that's what we need to do. That's what we need to do as leaders. That's what we need to do in our congregations. We need to say, how can we think differently? And if we open ourselves to that, then anything can happen.
I can add an anecdote to that. So as part of planning for the Entrepreneurial Ministry Program, I went along with John Gibbons to visit Rory MacDonald, who's a professor at Harvard Business School. And he's part of the Disruptive Innovation faculty, led by Clay Christensen. And so we're busy talking to him about the status of American religion. And he's actually a Mormon by background. But we were talking to him about, you know, the data, you know, the Pew data, which says, you know, mainstream Protestant religions are really falling off the face of the earth. I mean, the Presbyterian Church USA down 28% in 8 years. The Methodist UCC not very far behind. We're kind of holding our own, but declining share. And we were talking about the needs that religion meets, and the fact that the need to be part of a community of people who are actually in authentic, committed relationships with one another, the need to know that you have significance in the world, in your collective presence and being, those needs are not diminished at all. Those needs are skyrocketing. And he said, this is the ideal disruptive innovation case. And so he's interested in being part of our program because to him, it's a new case study to be written. But I think that's right. I think that what the needs that we serve as a religious people are not in any way declining. It may be the form. In fact, if anything, they're growing. They're growing. It's the form that might be challenged for next generations. I don't know. But if you look at other disruptive innovation scenarios, I mean, I'll just pick cabs and Uber as an example. The fact is that Yellow Cab could have done what Uber did, but they didn't do it because they were really well entrenched in their model of doing things. All the players were. And it was too complicated to figure out how to back out of that model. So Uber wasn't encumbered by that. They just had a different way of doing it, which had has some advantages. I think that is true in the way we approach religious community. It's very hard for us to change our institutional approach to doing this because we're really well entrenched in it. So what is likely to happen is that some people are going to come along on the periphery and they're going to have a very different way of doing it that actually works. And then I think what's going to happen is our institutional congregations are going to say, well, we could go that way. And I think they will, and I think it will work.
You're setting me up beautifully.
All right.
So that's
my point. I think that what we should take faith in is the fact that the need for religious community is not declining. Membership in churches is declining, but that's a different thing.
Yep.
And what will happen is someone will figure out how to meet those needs, and hopefully it will be us.
Or at least part of us.
I think it will be. I just came from a couple workshops that were like that, that were talking about that. I feel so blessed in the work that I do is I get to see a lot of the these beyond the congregations and beyond the new ways of doing. So how many of you were in opening, the first day of session when we welcomed in the new congregations and covenanting communities? And, you know, the covenanting communities, I have to say, that's an initiative of the board. Pulling together everybody was, like, pretty quick. We're easily going to double or triple that, if not even more. We're going to have to hire more staff to follow this. For the covenanting communities. And if you notice, there's an ing. It's covenant is not done. And what I see rising up in not just our established congregations and the emerging ministries and these new is this understanding of us being a covenanting people. And that will serve us so well because we don't have the dogma. We don't have the prescribed institution.
we get to make it up. That is our point, that we create, we're our authentic self in community, and our communities are authentic selves. We are the envy of other religions. So on my shirt, you had that research, there's a little research and evaluation. I am the UUA representative to the Faith Communities Today Consortium, which puts out, it's an interfaith consortium that does research. And we have these horribly timed surveys that go out. Some of you got them right before General Assembly. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And within that, so when we get together, we are the only denomination out of, I think there's 20 in the consortium. We're the only denomination to be totally online, the survey online. Other denominations, it's still paper. I was like, are you kidding me? Now, here's the entrepreneurial thing. I did not know how to put that very comprehensive kind of survey online. Do you know who helped us? The Nazarenes. Do you know why? My partner on the consortium said, you go where Jesus wants us to go, and we just can't get there yet. And I've heard that also from John Roberto, who's Catholic, who does these trainings for us all the time. So we're the cool kids. We are. I believe our time is here. Were you there for the celebration yesterday? We're the cool kids. It's our story that needs to change. And it's us coming into that story. I believe that we have, as somebody likes to coin, an ontology of optimism, which means the way that we look at the world is positive and full of possibilities. We are the religion of possibilities. That doesn't mean that we don't have tools for the grief, and to figure that we've got that too in our communities. So I think we are positioned, and here's another thing, statistically speaking. I wish I had slides. You know I love slides and bar graphs. Not because of the numbers, but because that there's stories in the numbers that help us break down assumptions. I get excited about numbers. We have generally about 160 adult members, and when I say, and it's such soft science, it's such soft data, because you all decide who gets to be a member, so it's going to be slightly different other places. So generally 160 people who identify as a member of a congregation, adults who identify. The last, 3 years ago, the census said we had 600,000 people who identify as UU who are, okay, 600,000, 160,000. I don't know about you. Oh, and also the numbers, I saw somewhere 800,000 in the last survey. I still can't trust that number. It's blowing my mind, so I kind of whisper it. Still, I don't know about you, but I see some major opportunity. And my goal is not to get them in our churches. My goal is to partner and find ways to claim each other in covenant, because there's too much work to do. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Amen. Yeah, exciting. All right. So we're going to open this up to questions. We have about 15 minutes or so. If you would come to the mic and share your name and your question or comment briefly so we can get a few people in. So just go ahead and line up at the mic.
Yeah, Rory Bowman from UUC Vancouver, Washington. A book I read this last 2 years ago, I guess, was The Personal MBA, which was basically a whole bunch of MBA program books summarized, sort of like a Reader's Digest version. And it's really helped me and a lot of the people I've worked with in the organizations. I was wondering if there were any books that you think a layperson could grab that would help provide insight into this that are worth reading, if you could only read one or two.
Things like Lean, I don't know if you, the startup community work has a lot to do with what we do. So a book called Lean Startups. There are also books around, I'm forgetting the name of it, a guy in Boulder wrote a book about startup communities, which is really helpful in thinking about how you form teams and what kind of support you need to do this work. So it's translating what the entrepreneurial and venture capital community has learned and, you know, putting it into language we can relate to.
You can also check with Bob Meese at our UU Society for Community Ministries booth, because he works with lay people intensively. In fact, they're meeting, there's a big group meeting in the exhibit hall right now. during this workshop. Did you have another one, Don, you're looking for?
I'm trying to get the name of it.
All right, we'll come back to it.
I'll get it.
I have.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, I'm not being flippant with this. Now, you know, words are not my first language. Harold and the Purple Crayon. So if you don't know, that's a children's book, and Harold has a little crayon, and he's always creating his own reality and moving it around. And I think that is one of, that's an incredibly profound entrepreneurial book. And also, I spend a lot of time studying, I'm not an expert, but I watch birds and trees in different ecosystems around the country when I travel, and that helps train my mind to look for other patterns. Mm-hmm. So to helping train your mind to look, to stretch in different ways. Oh, my teaching books on neuropsychology were probably the most helpful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I just want to add.
I found my book, so real quickly. Because we're doing this design thinking, I've been reading a lot of books about design thinking, creativity. Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within by Tom Kelly. He actually started the D School at Stanford. And you mentioned the Lean Startup, right? Yeah, and then Change by Design, and this is about design thinking, how design thinking informs organizations and inspires innovation.
I just want to add one other resource. There's a firm in Palo Alto called IDEO, and many of the people that are involved in design thinking have been in one way or another connected with it. They did a lot of work for Apple. They also did work for PepsiCo. And they have a lot of resources online for both social entrepreneurship as well as other kinds of entrepreneurship. And there are a lot of lessons in there that I think are important for us. One of them is the fact that you cannot think your way through the solution. You got to do rapid prototyping in cycles. But anyway, that's another resource.
And the D School at Stanford has amazing access to all their videos and resources on design thinking. So lots of great stuff you can get on the web.
Cool.
Okay. I'm John Ashby. UU Church of Davis. I want to add a little bit to what all you're saying and offer something a little different, especially to what you were saying. You know, the opportunity to serve the world is not the 600,000. You know, it's a much bigger thing than that. We're constantly hearing how the story that all the nuns don't want religion, and that's just wrong.
Can we just pause for a minute? When people are saying nuns, do you understand that they're saying N-O-N-E-S. Okay, just checking.
Yes, it's not that they don't want religion. It's that they don't want the product that religion is now providing them. And since we're already positioned accepting of different theologies, which is one of the things these people do want, you know, we've got, it's not just a head start. It's actually almost a moral obligation to get in there and serve them. And so I'd like to try and get the language changed a little bit from these nuns, they don't want religion, to rather this is a group that needs to be served and that we're positioned really well to have a chance to serve.
And I would say without losing our core identity, now is the time for
right.
us to get really clear
Absolutely.
With what it means and so that we can be differentiated and partner. And I would add to the wording of the nuns, we've got the nuns, the gons, and the duns. Okay? And we have not only do we have the nuns, we have the nuns, the gons, and the duns.
This is in response to are you religious or those
yeah.
kinds of questions. And stuff,
right, so. Right. And we have some, okay, so Sacred Fire from that Nathan Hollister's, Reverend Nathan Hollister's entrepreneurial ministry. He's a covenanting community now. They're full of people who did not identify as Unitarian Universalism, and Eric Resley, Washington, the sanctuaries D.C. The goal wasn't to reach Unitarian Universalists or convert people. It was to do just what you're saying, and many people are converting in the process, but that wasn't the goal, and it still isn't. So we're doing that.
Well, and I agree with you. And there are some people who are religion, the way we practice it, organize, is never going to do it with them. What's his last name? Faith Formation 20. They have this great
Roberto.
Thank you. I studied with him. You think I remember his name? They have this great quadrant they showed, and this was like the big aha when I saw this 5 years ago. And it shows like four different types of people. People who have grown up traditional religion, people who really, you know, they didn't, but they're okay, there's possibility. People who, people no way. And almost everything we have designed has been getting people into our doors. And looking at this quadrant for where people are at, we just basically wipe 50% of the people off this because they're never, ever going to step into our doors. Mm-hmm. And we can make Sundays be the most spectacular thing in the world. They're not going to come. Mm-hmm. So do we just say, oh, well, let's just give up 50% of the, and it's probably more than that, depending on what you read. Or are we going to say, how are we going to serve these folks? And so religion is, Peter likes to say something, it's a bad brand. It has a bad identity, and it kind of does. So how do we show different ways of doing it to meet the needs, as Brock says, it's never going to change.
Maybe also we can come back with a follow-up question on that in terms of some samples of what you might think about. Okay.
Hi, Kayla Parker. And my question is for you, Michelle, and I really want to respect your role as facilitator. And I think more than that, I want to hear your story, if you're willing.
Oh.
And I'm curious about what your community ministry is and how you see that playing into entrepreneurial ministership, ministry, or if you don't, because I think we've had really great examples from people who are doing institutional ministry, and I'm just wondering.
In a nutshell, I grew up working class, so like Tandy, there's a lot of similarities in our stories. Grew up in Ohio predominantly, so there's a lot of similarities. So first in the family to go to college, so I had a keen sense of class, later, after I graduated from college, I got involved with helping to found a youth ministry in Boston under the UU Urban Ministry. So that was my ministry for nearly 18 years, predominantly as a layperson, which is why I'm very sensitive to the needs and issues and concerns of providing support to lay people who consider their work ministry. So actively engaged in urban ministry for many years, exposed to a lot of trauma and violence and loss, in addition to beauty and joy and tremendous transformative learning. But after a while, I'm getting older and I did need to shift out of that. I did go back to school. I did become ordained. I'm also sensitive to the step between being a lay community minister to being ordained and what that was about for me in terms of a call, a need for more training, but retaining my sense and theological base that I am still called from the laity accountable to the communities that ordained me, which were two Unitarian Universalist congregations, technically, but also the laying out of hands of the community in Roxbury and Dorchester that I was serving. So those people laid hands on me, and those are the people to whom I feel accountable. After becoming a minister, and along the way, I was also a clinical social worker, so I had that all in the mix as well. Went back for my degree in practical theology and got a doctorate in practical theology. So a lot of my ministry right now is academic ministry, trying to also get my dissertation in print. Studied still urban ministry and trauma and violence. But I'm also a pastoral psychotherapist part-time too. So and I've traveled in and out of congregations as well. So that's my story in a nutshell.
My name's Keelan. I'm a member of First Church here in Portland. Do you think that the optimism and flexibility of thinking that it sounds like is part of being an entrepreneurial minister can be taught?
Well, I guess we did, or we wouldn't have put a two-year class together. It's costing a few thousand bucks and a lot more in investment. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it can be. And, I mean, there's a question, like, can you teach and what can you teach? What we're trying to do is teach skills. I think that, you know, we have different, there's different Myers-Briggs, there's different Enneagrams, there's different ways. I mean, I was thinking and listening to Michelle and Tandy. You know, I grew up in San Francisco, but also single family, single mother. I started working on the streets in San Francisco, 9 years old. I had a bad entrepreneurial start. I was shining shoes, but it was 1967. I was 9 years old. It was the Haight-Ashbury. So I failed at my first entrepreneurial effort. But I adapted and started going into bars where the people said, oh, we'll give this cute kid some money. So, but I think you can teach the skills for people to think differently. Mm-hmm. I think you can teach skills to learn different things. I don't think you're born, you know, it's like, oh, there's an entrepreneur. No, I mean, it doesn't happen like that. You can learn skills. And there's definitely some characteristics that that maybe people have that are more into that than others. And they've actually done some studies on this, and they have proven that you can teach these skills for folks to look at the world in new ways and learn skills to do it.
my name is Katie Swanson. I'm a candidate for ministry, and I'm doing my residency in a hospital right now, working in an ICU. And I know that religion is not a declining commodity in a hospital setting, specifically in an ICU. And so I'm just thinking about that and thinking about entrepreneurial ministry and thinking about my call, which feels like it's very much to chaplaincy, and wondering what you think about like that, what I just said about religion in a hospital and entrepreneurial ministry and where those two overlap.
I would like, okay, so what do I think? I think that we should have coffee and get out big butcher paper and a bunch of markers and just map this thing out. Oh, and I want to go back to, can it be taught? So as a teacher who used to train teachers as to how to apply neuropsychology into a classroom, I had kids that would come to me who were severely traumatized early on, and I would get them, my first classroom was third grade, and we had the Wonder Kids of third grade, and I got permission from the school board. They were throwaway kids. I hate to say it, but that's, the school board said, we don't care what you do with them. Just make sure they stop pulling the screens out of the windows because those are expensive. And I pulled in a lot of our curriculum, our UU curriculum, because it had to do with teaching compassion and mutuality and doing away with shame. And we did community building. It was like a mini youth group in third grade. And then, a lot of the kids didn't have toys to play with. And so I brought in toys that were more apt to find in a like, kindergarten, first grade classroom. And they would have a lot of time to play, a lot of time to have elders come in and read to them. And what we found is their brains and their attitude, their whole, it started clicking, clicking, clicking. And so by mid-year, we started introducing academics slowly. And we had kids testing out of special ed.
Hmm.
They could not figure out what was going on in our classroom, and it was because, and so those of you who have been to the Lareda Con, I came in, or later conference a couple years ago, we did these play stations, and you know, when I say Harold and the Purple Crayon, I know I'm taking a risk of people not taking me seriously, but we don't play enough as a people. There's so many words, and we do this awful thing to each other of intellectual bullying, and that shuts down entrepreneurialism. It shuts down the creativity. And entrepreneurialism, that flexibility of mind, comes from a place of joy and trust and play.
Yeah, let me add a book just really quickly to get to this. Go get a book. You have to read this called Orbiting the Giant Hairball.
Yes.
Orbiting the Giant Hairball, a Corporate Fool's Guide to Surviving with Grace. And it talks about how we shut down a creativity, and by the second grade, people don't think they can draw anymore. And it's written by a guy who was at Hallmark for years, and it's a great book about teaching and learning this stuff, Orbiting the Giant Hairball.
I don't want to lose. Was your question how to apply entrepreneurial ministry in the hospital setting?
Especially when we're talking, like when I hear entrepreneurial ministry, I hear we're trying to pull people in.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing is reaching out.
Absolutely.
If we go back to basics of Don's basic definition, pulling from the root meaning of the word, it's finding new ways to serve.
Right.
So just bringing that creative, joyful energy into the hospital setting and finding new activities and new ways. When I worked in the Alzheimer's unit of a hospital, I began to bring music and song in, okay? And to me, that was an entrepreneurial piece that hadn't been utilized in that particular nursing home setting before. Okay, so it's a very broad thing, just to bring and to go back to what Tandy, it's just to like open up joy and creativity and just be open to the way the spirit moves mysteriously, right?
I just wanted to add. I spent a year and a half as a resident chaplain in a 1,100 bed trauma hospital in Tampa, and it was the most fabulous formation experience ever. But what I realized is that in moments of life crisis, you get clear about what's important. And the need for religious community or spiritual community is very clear, and community of all kinds, very clear in that moment. And all the other stuff gets stripped away. The doctrine recedes into the background. And that is why being there in ministry is entrepreneurial. I mean, it's extending the reach of liberal religion in a really vital way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're getting close to the end, so we'll see how we do here.
So I really appreciate this conversation about the habits of mind and what can be learned and what needs to maybe be innate, and how we bring that mindset to how we think about what we're doing and the spirit of service in which we play in the world. Mm-hmm. Love that. And there's a hierarchy of needs piece where I wonder if it's a separate workshop, to have a conversation around being a mid-career ordained minister myself and having to actually pay off my seminary debts. How do we spread out, on a nuts and bolts level, how do we spread out the financial risk of these experiments that might fail, and make sure that we're kind of doing a diffuse community investment in these entrepreneurial ideas, rather than relying on somebody already having a paycheck from somebody, or the wherewithal somehow to eat without needing a paycheck. You know, can we?
I was part of the summit on the economic sustainability in ministry a few weeks ago, and we used some of these entrepreneurial tools in thinking through some of these issues. So design thinking, and we've got a couple of initiatives that are coming out, kind of addressing what you're doing. I shouldn't say initiatives; that makes it sound a lot more than it is. We're going to have some playful experiments about this stuff. So there's people working on it, and we can talk more later.
I do want to respect the time that we are at 4:15 right now for those folks who need to go. But you can go ahead and ask a question.
Hi, Les Polgar, Mount Diablo, UU Church, Walnut Creek. Don asked at the start how many are ministers here, but he didn't, so he's a minister. I'm an entrepreneur, so I'd like to know how many entrepreneurs are here, meaning you started a company or ran a startup company. May I? It's just great. I think the observation is that it isn't as bizarre on having ministers learn entrepreneur ministry, Unitarian ones, because to the extent they can be taught, we may be the only denomination where really original sin is off the table. It's gone. So that the fear of being always inadequate and insufficient, the freedom to fail is ours, uniquely among organized denominations. That, to me, is why UUs are particularly well-suited to be an entrepreneurial ministry.
Amen.
Right on.
Hear, hear.
Hi, my name is Deborah Landis, and I'm with Emerson Unitarian Universalist Church in Houston, Texas. And I'm in this is a very practical question on the process of changing professions. I'm 55, and I have an opportunity to take a different direction with my life. And I hear that all of you have done that at one time or another. And I'm wondering, is there a place that I can go on the UUA website where it says, here are the 30 lay community ministry positions that we have open, and this is how it works? I also have some entrepreneurial ideas of my own, but I'm not sure that's where I want to start. So that's my question. Or questions, I guess.
Well, I'm not the UUA, so I'm jumping in here a little bit. I know that one of the things that we're talking about, and the UUSCM has been promoting lay ministry that's not ordained, but we're aware that there's this gap that seems to be you're a dedicated lay leader who's got lots of opportunities, or you go to seminary, and there's a big gap in the middle for what's this look like. Other denominations have deacons, things, so there's lots of conversation about how we can tap into, I think, and deepen and broaden the skills of folks who aren't going to go an ordained path. The UUSCM's been doing it. The UUA is starting to look more into that as well.
Okay, last question over here.
I go to a church in Norfolk, Virginia, and I'm one of 7 African Americans there. And so I love my church. But I feel like my church specifically and UU in general lacks people of color. And so I came here so that I could figure out ways to increase our numbers. Suggestions. Fix it.
I do know there's a couple.
418.
There's a couple churches within churches that are trying to have more communities of color, congregations that's part of the mission or part of the intention. John Questwell with Awake Ministries is one of them, and then Adam Dyer is a is he or I think he's just becoming ordained or he just got ordained.
A PhD or something.
He comes out of a religious education, religious educator, and he's really interested in starting universalist churches that are primarily planted in communities of color. So check out Adam Dyer, D-Y-E-R, or I can.
And John Cresswell is a member of our entrepreneurial ministry program as well.
I also think that opening up the idea of commissioning lay ministers, deacons, is going to open up a path for a lot of people to be more interested in our congregations. I think we limit ourselves in our expansion in all types of diversity because we don't have different kinds of levels of recognizing the work that is done as ministry, you know, and that calls to people oftentimes to experience and have affirmed their work as ministry.
We need entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. And entrepreneurs.
And entrepreneurs.
Thank you, everybody. I'm sure, did you have
it? Yeah, if I'm given a strategy, then I have no problem with taking it back to my church. And, you know, it's three churches in the area. And we're buying a new building. And we can't fill this one. And so I'm trying to figure out what we're going to do. Because we are urban, we're seven cities, and so we have to do something. And so I'm willing to take something back.
Yeah. Your emerging ministry coach is Kathy McGowan, who's a wonderful thought partner, and she's planted congregations before. For any of you, the staff actually sits just front and to the left of the stage during session so that you can come find us and get us out for meetings. So Kathy McGowan.
And I think it's important to remember not to lock ourselves into thinking that Sunday morning at 11 o'clock is the way all ministries and connection to our faith tradition is going to be. We got to break out of that box, seriously. All right, thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank
I'm
you,
sure
everybody.
People will be happy to answer more questions.
Always fun, you two. So what's the deal, though? What's the only certain people
get? My being abandoned, and I need
only certain people
Do you
get
want
pops.
A lollipop?
No, it's okay.
Hey,
Candy offered me one.
Him? Okay.
Were you? Were
you got
really?
Both of us.
In what capacity?
Turn off the mic. This is
kind of a secret. It's a long struggle.
But it's just, I think it's an amusing.
Am I going? I'm not.
That's actually part of it.
No.
My last job was health and wellness innovation.
Oh, okay.
And so.
When was that? About
8 years? Oh, it was a while ago, yeah. It was 9 years ago.
9 years ago, yes.
Yeah. And so we were opening up Whole Foods and a bunch of the natural channel, but.
I'm always advised.
Trying to figure out.
Yeah. Send me an email. We can get
this. Oh, you were?
Yes. I think I'm going to be up there this year. Conference like the second week of August. So.
They're getting traction.
Yeah,
finally,
they do a lot of
on some of those.
I love that organization. It's the UCC. If you're not familiar with them, you should check them out.
What can you do again? What do we just do?
Okay. All right. You know how to get a hold of me, right? There you go.
They gave up on potatoes because the standards were just eliminated the spray that's on potatoes. And that means they can't do any more inorganic potatoes because they'd have to freeze them. So the potato chips are on the table. Just kill them.
There's other stuff to be done. Here, nice to meet you.
An idea for both of you to think about, if not to do personally, at least think about who might be interested in. I mean, any of these, by the way, Augusta. Spent my career as a professor in medical school. The last part of my career, I originated and spearheaded the development of a biomedical ethics program that was case-based online in computers. It's still being used 20 years later, where the doctor is presented with a problem. You know, pull the plug, a potential request for an abortion, those kinds of things. Then the doctor consults with the hospital chaplain, the ethicist, the lawyer, or whatever, to pull in the information as they need it, because that's how we learn. We learn things when we need it as adults. There are a lot more business schools than there are medical schools. All of them teach ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of having somebody with you guys' background design this kind of interactive program, I don't know, we literally don't know how many thousands of pages are of resources are available in the 10 cases that we wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to have that available, to give your ethical training and background and business background, the practicalities of how you apply that, could just be fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. One of the
for
one
business
of the,
business yeah. community as a
yeah.
customer.
One of the ideas that came out of when we were doing the brainstorming at this economic summit, one of the ideas that popped up was, what if we intentionally, seated corporate boards with Unitarian Universalists? I mean, you serve in a corporate board, you get $10,000-$20,000 a year, right? I mean, the big corporations, right?
More than
what,
that.
Right. What if we started seating those boards with Unitarian Universalist people who bring ethics and values to the conversation and have the savviness to be on a board, and that money goes into the fund for Unitarian Universalism or something?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of these entrepreneurial ministry things, they're providing needed services, but they don't know how to monetize it, because the only
right.
way we know how to monetize
right.
things is pledges or grants to
right.
each, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like this, wait a minute, you're providing a religious service
mm-hmm.
to people, if you will. But you're monetizing it differently. It's cool.
Okay.
It's a cool idea. Yeah.
So, if it's of interest to you and you want to bounce ideas off of me,
I have. I'm getting
there.
That's
are you guys
really
out
fun.
There? Go ahead, talk and I'll
are
catch
you
up.
Are you an ethics person by background?
No.
No.
I was a research scientist.
I skimmed David White. I don't know if I have it. So I'd love to.
Also,
I've studied, I can write him for a sermon, not the whole book. You know what that means, right?
You psychologist.
He's one of the guys I wanted to interview. I was kind of working on this book during sabbatical.
So can we go online
people,
and see this?
I wanted, he's one of the guys on my list to talk to.
Or is that proprietary? You got to have
a... It's proprietary. I probably can...
He's been doing this for a long time.
I may...
Right.
Okay. Well, I don't want to go outside the bounds, but it'd be interesting to see the example.
It would be, and I'd like for you to see how it works.
Yeah.
No kidding. Is he still?
Because, when you're presented with this kind of what do? You think about it a little bit, and then you say, I need to talk to somebody.
Right.
Mm. And extroverts have to talk to somebody.
Right.
Ooh,
right.
Sounds like the guy I'd like to hang out with.
So, call a colleague.
Yeah.
I've got this patient that's driving me nuts.
Right. The boss I mentored, my mentor in the 90s, that I used to meditate with.
We
used to read his stuff.
Well, so I would love to explore that further with you. And I got your card, so I'll send you my contact information.
We just keep having more reasons to talk to them.
Follow up on
I'm not going
to
let go of you.
Intriguing idea.
I mean, I have an MBA degree, so that I've been through the business ethics course as it was taught 25 years ago.
Yeah.
I need to get to another meeting. I'm sorry.
No,
I mean, Andy, thank you for the idea. It's a really good one.
Okay, I just think that
that's
it could be
we should explore.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Very worthwhile.
No, absolutely.
You know, way to reach future generations.
I love it. Pardon?
I'm wondering if you have a statement for two needs that we will continue to have my type of remember that part of the
No, let's see, the two needs you said?
Yeah, you articulated two things.
I'm trying to reorient where I was.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though we are not having brick and mortar, it doesn't go away of anything that gets greater.
I don't know exactly what I said, but this isn't exactly what I said, but I have a friend who says there's an epidemic of loneliness and alienation alive in the world, and so the need to help people be in community with one another and to help them find their true sense of selves and bring their whole selves to it is really, I think, the work of ministry. And there's that the market for that is not decreasing.
Right.
You know?
It's just a to find one for people who are what they want and to bring that to what? To the world?
Yeah, to bring, yeah.
And the need for community.
Yeah. 445.
we just all need to know that we have, our lives matter, and that the way we know that is by figuring out what it is we bring and figuring out how to bring that in a way that meets the needs of others. You know, that's really what I think ministry is all about. People that are engaged in doing that work will find a big need.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.